Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. And it's an open forum today. 2 hours of open forum with Jimmy Akin. Perfect time to call 888-318-7884. Because when Jimmy's here, the lines will fill up quickly. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884. If you have a question about anything else, you're also welcome to call 888-318-7884. Anybody welcome. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
I hope you are doing well on this Thursday.
Doing great. How about you?
Pretty good. Are you in the path of all the we've been seeing all these storms on the TV here? Are you in the path of all?
Not all of them. I mean, they're not converging on Northwest Arkansas, but
well, that's a relief.
Yeah. But we're expecting to get some precipitation tonight and tomorrow and some snow. And hopefully I'm going to set out a pan tonight and hopefully I'll get enough to make a bowl of snow ice cream.
And how do you do that? I don't know how to make snow ice cream. Is there a
really?
Recipe? No, I don't.
You grew up in Boston. You never had snow ice cream?
Not that I recall. No,
okay.
I don't.
Okay. Well, there are different ways of doing it. The way that we did it when I was a kid is you take snow and you add sugar and you add vanilla and you mix it all up and then you've got snow ice cream. Huh. There are fancier ways of doing it, though. For example, instead of adding sugar, you could add sweetened condensed milk, which will give it a creamier texture.
Oh, yeah.
And so we got snow a few days ago. I went out to the store and got the supplies for snow ice cream. Unfortunately, we had only enough snow that I could make a few spoonfuls, and so I didn't open a can of sweetened condensed milk. And I didn't use sugar. I used a non-caloric sweetener. But I got a few spoonfuls, and I'm hoping I'll get enough snow before the winter's over to make a whole bowl.
Oh, I hope you do. I hope you do, yeah. Jimmy. The number here is 888-318-7884. It's open forum, and that means, in addition to being open to anything, any question, that means open to anyone. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Anyone is welcome. 888-318-7884. Tomorrow, a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will drop, and we are expecting what should we be expecting, Jimmy?
We're going to be talking about the Holy Fire. Are you familiar with that? Okay. So this is a miracle that's reported in Eastern Christian circles every year at Easter.
Okay.
Some officials from Eastern Christian churches go in to the tomb of Christ at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, and they come out bearing fire that is on some candles they have, and all of the pilgrims who are there expecting them to come out with the fire have their own candles, and they spread this fire around, you know, from candle to candle. And they even take it in special containers on airplanes to various world leaders in different countries, particularly Eastern Christian countries. And so this is widely understood as a miracle that occurs every year. It's popularly understood that way, but there's a question about, is this event actually a miracle or not? And so we're going to be given the background on the Holy Fire, and then we're going to look at the question of, is this a miracle or is it something else? Is it a pious custom that is popularly regarded as a miracle?
Okay. The Holy Fire tomorrow morning on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Just go to mysterious.fm and you can find it. Jimmy, every line full already. Shall we go to the phones?
Sure. Only way to open them up. Well, other than just hang up on everybody, but I don't want to do that.
Don't, Edgar. That was not a suggestion, Edgar. Colin's in Canada listening on Catholic.com. Colin, thanks for starting us off today. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi,
Colin.
I know we can truly merit reward from God through acts of charity, but if we commit a mortal sin and then are returned to a state of grace after that, is it only the acts of charity after returning to a state of grace which merit reward, or will the acts of charity previous to the mortal sin still merit reward?
The church does not have a teaching on this, but the standard theological opinion is what's known as the revival of merits. And so the idea is that when you commit a mortal sin, you're turning your back on the life of supernatural love that you had led up to that point, and therefore you're turning your back on all of the acts of love that is what merits a reward. you're turning your back on all of those prior acts of love that you did, and so you won't receive a reward when you're in hell. On the other hand, when you repent and you turn back to God and reaffirm love of God, you are reaccepting all of the and reaffirming all of the acts of love that you did under the action of God's grace. And so consequently, all of the good works, to use St. Paul's term for them, all of the good works that you did prior to your fall into mortal sin will be revived, and you will receive a reward for them.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before.
Mm-hmm. It's called the Revival of Merit. You can look it up.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Colin. Thanks for getting us started. 888-318-7884, the number. It is open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and now we go down to Texas. John's in Texas watching on YouTube. Hi, John. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Mr. Akin. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir, John. And just so folks know, you don't need to ask if I can hear you okay. If we can't hear you, we'll tell you.
Yes, sir. All right. My two-part question today is, what is your timeline of events that happened prior to the fall? Where did diseases, death, and other natural evils come from? Last week, I asked you about Romans 8:21, and this is my fault. I should have read the verses to you. I'll read them briefly. Romans 8:20-21 says, "For the creation was subjected to frustration," some translations say futility, "not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in the hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God." I don't believe Paul is referring to human creation here, because in verse 23, two verses later, Paul writes, "And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruit of the Spirit, grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons." Do you hold to something like the angelic fall theodicy to explain natural evils?
Okay, so we're starting from a different interpretation of this, and so that's going to affect my answer to your question. Just so I'm clear on the two parts of your question, you asked first, when do I think that things like disease and death came from? And secondly, where do you think I think they came from? Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So my interpretation is in Romans 8, when Paul refers to creation, he's referring to human creation. It's like if I said, oh, the whole of creation knows that Joe Biden is the current president of America. I'm not claiming that every microbe knows that or every rock knows that. I'm talking about the human creation. He's the most famous, you know, political leader in the world. Or if I said, or some other political leader, I could say the whole of creation or the whole world, same thing. The whole of creation knows that Vladimir Putin is the leader of Russia. It would be the same thing. I mean the whole human creation. And I think that's what St. Paul is talking about here. The whole of human creation, because it's fallen, has been subjected to futility or frustration in the wake of the fall of man. And that was something that was in accord with God's will. So we're living with a fallen human creation. And to illustrate the depth of that, St. Paul then says, and even we who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we're subject to that. So that's where I'm coming from on this. And consequently, I would say that disease and death are coterminous, and I'll explain that, but it means they've been around as long as we've had life forms. And I would point to the Catechism of the Catholic Church for support for that. It notes that it, as part of God's plan for the world, there is a continuous, the world is created in a state of journeying towards its final destiny. And as long as that journey is incomplete, it contains both creative and destructive elements, the creation of some life forms and the disappearance of others. And so there isn't a specific point other than the first appearance of life where death also came into the world. The first life form, whatever it was, something microbial, no doubt, is no longer alive. And so death came into the world not too long after the appearance of life. And that's, even though Aquinas wouldn't have had the time scale that modern scientists proposed. He essentially agreed with that. He said, and I think this is right, human death entered the world through the fall. But the nature of creatures like carnivores, like lions and tigers, that didn't change. So even before the fall of man, you would have had, you know, lions eating gazelles and tigers eating whatever tigers eat over in Asia. And there would have been animal death and plant death before the fall. We even see, as I think I mentioned last week, plant death before the fall, because God gives Adam and Eve permission to eat from the tree of, from any tree in the garden except the tree of life. And when you eat plants, the plant matter that you're eating dies. So we already see plant death in the world prior to the fall. And we're never told that animal death is something new with the fall. What God says to Adam and Eve is he gives them access to the tree of life. So as long as they eat from that, they'll stay alive. But he says, if you eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you'll die. And when they do eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they're kicked out of Eden. So they no longer have access to the tree of life, but and therefore they'll die. But other animals aren't living in Eden either. They don't have, you know, not all the animal population of the world lived in the Garden of Eden, so they didn't have access to the Tree of Life to keep them alive, and they were naturally subject to death. As Aquinas says, every natural system is subject to corruption or decay, and it will therefore run down or break down over time unless it's specially propped up by grace. In the case of mankind, we had access to that grace prior to the fall, but we don't have an indication from Genesis that other creatures did as well. We've got really good evidence from the fossil record that there was death in the world prior to the arrival of mankind, and the Catechism acknowledges that. It refers to the process of evolution, where you have the development of new life forms and the extinction of other life forms as part of God's plan.
John, I'm going to leave it there because we've got to go to that first break, but thank you for the question. I hope that was helpful. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
On Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Father Joseph and Doug Keck mind decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Mother dishes out teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers as she takes calls from her family.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, now that we've started the new year, we invite you to join the hundreds of people who are already taking the St. Peter's 20 Answers Challenge. Here's how it works. You visit shop.catholic.com today and pick up your St. Peter's 20 Answers sampler, a great collection of 30 books that you can pick up for a great price right now. Then you begin your own version of St. Peter's 20 Answers Challenge. That's reading all 30 books in the collection during 2024. Easily doable if you put your mind to it. And think how much you'll learn from all that, how many answers you'll get. 600 answers, as a matter of fact, across those 30 books. You can pick up your copy of St. Peter's 20 Answers sampler right now at shop.catholic.com. shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an open forum, and every line full except for one. Line two is open if you want it. 888-318-7884. We'll go to Caesar now in Odessa, Texas, watching on Facebook. Caesar, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Hi. Before Christmas, I had a few coworkers invite me to their non-denominational church services. But I denied them primarily because we were leaving the country for the holidays. Mm-hmm. But I also didn't just want to say, no, thank you, I'm Catholic. So I can answer them. How can I answer them without boasting about the church being the fulfillment of Jesus, but opening a door for a conversation if they want to have that.
Okay. Well, I might decouple the two things. If they invite you, now in this case, you could easily say, oh, I appreciate it, but no thanks, I'm going to be out of the country for the holidays. On the other hand, if they say, hey, if they renew the invitation and they say, hey, do you want to come to our non-denominational church? You can say, oh, I appreciate the invitation. I thank you very much. You can actually go to their Protestant church. It's not a fulfillment of your Sunday obligation. So you're going to need to make sure you go to a Catholic church to fulfill your Sunday obligation. But for the sake of friendship or opening a dialogue or things like that, you could go to their church and you could say, hey, I'm open to doing that if you're open to visiting my Catholic church. And you could have a reciprocal, exchange where you go to their church and they come to your church, and then you can get together afterwards and have a conversation about, you know, what they saw and what you saw and the differences between the churches. And that way you're not, as you indicated, Caesar, you're not, starting from a position of triumphalism, of trying to look down on them. You're effectively putting yourself on the same level. Now, you and I know that, okay, the Catholic Church is the true church, but you're not boasting of that fact up front. Instead, you're saying, hey, we could have an exchange here. We could both use this as an opportunity to learn more about each other. And that would be perfectly fine. If you don't want to go to their church, you could say, well, I appreciate the invitation. I think it's great you're going to church. That's wonderful. I happen to be Catholic. And so that's where I go to church. And if you ever want to have a conversation about that, I'm happy to discuss it with you.
Caesar?
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Caesar, if you want to hang on, I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness, and Where to Find It. I think you'll enjoy the book. And also, it's got a lot in there that you might share with others. So hang on if you'd like a copy of it. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Kevin's in New York listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Kevin, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks for having me. So, Jimmy, my question is, a lot of Protestants who are well-versed in history will use the point that for the first, 1,000 years or so, 900 years, the church fathers didn't actually unanimously say there are exactly seven sacraments. They do mention them, right? But mm-hmm. Some of them give more numbers, some of them give less numbers. So they're not, they're not denying that penance or marriage is a sacrament, but there's never seven until at least the, 1000s, 1200s. What's a reasonable explanation for that? Why wouldn't the church early on say these are distinct ordinances or rites from, holy water or holy salt? Why were they kind of bunched in together with some church fathers?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't say it's never seven until the Middle Ages, but there is certainly a diversity of number of sacraments that are proposed by different Christian authors. And the fundamental reason for that is the term sacrament has changed meaning over time. So it applied to different numbers of things. Originally, the term sacramentum, which is a Latin term, meant something like oath or secret. And there were certain, it came to be applied in a Christian context to certain rites that were sacred that Christians would do. And initially, that was basically all something needed to be considered a sacrament. So if you blessed salt or you blessed holy water, then it would become sacred. That's what the blessing does. It's what makes it holy. And so you could have any number of different sacred things, as a result of blessings. Coronation of kings was one of those sometimes. You could have blessings of friendships. You could have all kinds of different blessings. And consequently, you had all kinds of different sacred rites that you could call sacraments. Eventually, though, by the time of the Middle Ages, the term sacrament began to be used in a way that required some additional conditions. In addition to it being a rite that was sacred in some way, it needed to be established by Jesus, and it needed to convey God's grace in a kind of special way, where we have a promise from God that if you do the right, he'll give you his grace, and assuming you're not putting a barrier in the way, like mortal sin or something like that. And so that then led to a period where authors began to reflect on, well, how many, under this new definition, how many such rights are there? How many sacred rights are there that were established by Jesus and that will convey grace? And when they reflected on that, you know, you started to have a consolidation around a smaller number of sacraments. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Peter Lombard who wrote a very influential work of theology in the Middle Ages known as the Sentences, that that proposed that there are essentially seven such rites that meet these conditions. And following Peter Lombard, the number seven became widely accepted as people had a chance to reflect on it. It's like, yeah, it seems these seven meet those conditions. And all the sacred rites that didn't meet those conditions, we then came up with a new term for. And today they're called sacramentals. And so we have a difference between sacraments, which are the ones that Jesus established to communicate grace, and other sacred rites that are now called sacramentals. So the reason you had this flexibility in terms of number of sacraments, whether it was, you know, way more than seven or around seven or even less than seven, was because the term sacrament was flexible in its meaning and didn't acquire its modern meaning until the Middle Ages.
That's a great explanation. Thank you.
Caleb, yeah, no problem.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that question. It's open forum. All the lines are full, so on we go. We're going to Phil in Canada, watching on YouTube. Phil, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you so much for having me on, gentlemen. I'm a longtime listener.
Oh, well, we're glad to have you, Kevin. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Phil. I apologize, Phil. Welcome, Phil. I made a mistake there.
No problem at all. One thing I'm having trouble reconciling in my mind is I'm curious why, as Catholics, we are permitted to embalm our deceased relatives. I see it as, we're quite strict as Catholics, which I like, that believe in the resurrection of our bodies. And so, you know, putting things into the sewer system doesn't seem like that's, in the same vein as that, or it not being environmentally friendly is not taking care of our earth, or even exposing funeral home workers to unhealthy chemicals. I'm not seeing how that's permitted.
Okay. Well, in any system of law, liberty is presumed. So unless there's a rule against something, you're allowed to do it. So what would be reasons why we should not embalm our loved ones? What makes that unacceptable in your eyes?
Just kind of curious. First and foremost, just with our belief in the resurrection of our bodies at the end, trying to keep the body intact was kind of one thought. And so kind of pushing bodily fluids, into the sewer system doesn't seem in line with kind of keeping that body intact, as well as being environmentally friendly, an idea that I was kind of thinking that perhaps that's not taking care of the earth that, God's entrusted us with. And then, of course, our fellow brothers and sisters who are, doing the embalming, who are working for the funeral home, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exposing them to either carcinogenics or at a minimum, something not so healthy.
Okay, so let's take those one by one. The first one you mentioned was the first two that you actually mentioned were both essentially variations on a common theme. Now, it's true that God's going to raise the body on the last day. We're all going to be resurrected. And that may, although this is not actually church teaching, that may involve the same matter that was in the body when it was alive. It obviously won't involve all of the same matter that was in the body when it was alive, because matter passes in and out of us over the course of our lifetimes. You know, a given atom that's in my body presently may not be there a month from now and may not be there at the time of my death. So matter passes through us all the time. And it's really up to God what matter he's going to use to resurrect us with. But just supposing that God wants to use the same matter we had in us at the time of our death, there's something very interesting to say that I'll say on the other side of the break.
Jimmy's like a professional at this, leaving you with the tease. All right, we'll come back with an answer to that question and more with Jimmy Akin of Catholic Answers Live. Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore. Visit whyweirecatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music for you there. A professional radio tease before we went to the break. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's an open forum, and he was in the midst of answering a question from Phil in Canada about why we permit embalming in the Catholic Church. And Jimmy, take it away.
Yeah, so let's suppose God decides that he wants to use exactly the same matter for your resurrected body that was in your body at the time of your death. Well, that matter could all be concentrated in one place. You know, like if we just took your body and stuck it in a grave with no embalming, but it also could be scattered, you know, like in the case of people who get cremated and then they have their relatives scatter their ashes. That's not the Catholic custom, but it is something that some people do. Mm-hmm. And if you want to project into the future, well, you could even, you know, put someone's body in a transporter and dematerialize it and rematerialize it in scattered atom form throughout the cosmos. Well, you know, so let's consider those three options. You know which of those, Cycelet, is the hardest for God to go get that matter with that was in your body at the very moment of death in order to create your resurrected body? Which of those would you say is the hardest for God?
The last one.
Why?
Well, I don't I'm not sure. I think I might have missed one or two.
Okay. Well, let me make it easy for you.
Yeah.
Nothing is hard for God.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because God has infinite resources. He's omnipotent. When we think of something as hard, it's because we have limited resources that we have to expend on accomplishing something. But we are finite. God is infinite, and therefore God has infinite resources to do anything with, and therefore everything is equally easy for God. So it's not like we need to keep the matter in one place or it's going to be harder for God to resurrect someone. And actually, in the typical course of nature, the matter does scatter. You know, God tells Adam, dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. And what does dust do? Well, it scatters. You know, even if you put it in, underground in a grave, water's going to seep through. It's going to carry particles that used to be in someone's body away as that water moves through the ground. So we already have natural scattering of the atoms that were in our body. And it's not a strain for God to pull those back together if that's what he chooses to do, because everything is equally easy for God because he's got unlimited resources. And consequently, we don't need to be concerned about, do we need to keep the body together? Not for God's sake. And we actually do substantially keep the body together. If we embalm our loved ones, most of their body stays together, but you know, parts of it, like bodily fluids, may be taken out of the body, or you know, things like that. But that's not creating a— we already have that happening as part of the natural processes anyway, and it's not going to make it any harder for God. The second article that Phil mentioned is he was concerned about is, and this is related to the first, he was concerned about, is this friendly to nature? Well, we can't create or annihilate matter. You know, we're not God. All we can do is move matter around. And so it doesn't matter whether you embalm someone or disintegrate them or cremate them or whatever. Those atoms have to go somewhere. We can't, you know, they're going to remain in the material world. And therefore, it's just a question of where are you going to put them? You know, it doesn't harm nature to have those atoms around, whether they were parts of bodily fluids or something else. And the death of an individual human being, while it's going to have a local effect, is not really going to have a global effect. So we're not doing any kind of systemic damage to the planet by, you know, discharging some bodily fluids or something like that, provided we're doing it in a sanitary way. I mean, if you just stuck the body in a grave, the microbes are going to eat it anyway. You know, you're going to have human decay actually on an even greater scale. If you don't embalm, if you just put someone in a grave, you're going to have human decay happening in the earth anyway. And it's going to be on an even greater scale, because one of the things that they do when they embalm you is they arrange it so that the decay process is dramatically slowed down. They, for example, may replace bodily fluids with formaldehyde, which is a chemical that kills microbes and therefore will preserve the body for longer. And consequently, by the introduction of formaldehyde, you're actually going to retard the process of decay. And it's— and so you're— if it's unsanitariness of having parts of human remains like bodily fluids in the earth, well, you're actually being more friendly by retarding the human decay that would otherwise occur. But that brings up formaldehyde, which leads to Phil's third question about, is it good for funeral home workers, for morticians, to be exposed to chemicals like this? Well, formaldehyde is a toxic chemical, but that— just because something's toxic doesn't mean that humans are forbidden to use it. Lots of things are toxic. Alcohol is toxic, but that doesn't mean humans should never be exposed to alcohol. In fact, in various settings like hospitals, they need to use alcohol and other disinfectants. And that's basically what formaldehyde is. It's a disinfectant. So it's not that you can't use something just because it's a disinfectant, which means it's toxic to microbes and possibly humans. It just means you need to manage that. And you need to not take unacceptable risks. You need to use things like formaldehyde and other toxic substances in with prudence and caution so that you're not putting people at undue risk. And as long as you're not putting funeral home workers at undue risk, then there's not a fundamental moral problem here. So those are some of the considerations that I would use to respond to the concerns Phil raised. I also would point out that that we have precedent for embalming in Scripture itself. As I've mentioned with you, Cy Kellett, there are at least two people in the Bible who are very closely connected to the history of ancient Israel that were in fact embalmed, because in Egypt they embalmed people. Now they did it a little differently than we do it. They, for example, they didn't use formaldehyde. Instead, they used a substance called natron, which is kind of a combination of salt and baking soda. It occurs naturally in the desert in Egypt, but they would get natron, and for a period of like 30 days, they would remove the organs of the body, they would pack the body with natron, and that would absorb the moisture of the body so that there would not be moisture for the microbes to use in decomposing the body, and that would retard the process of decomposition. And this was part of the mummification process, the full sweep of which, including all the burial rites and stuff, took about 70 days. And there are two closely connected figures with Israel's history that were mummified in Egypt. Do you know their names, Cy Kellett?
I think it would be Joseph.
That's one of them. Yep.
And then his father mummified, or?
Jacob, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Israel himself, because Jacob is Israel. Israel himself was mummified. And that kind of sets a precedence, you know, saying, hey, it doesn't look like there's anything wrong here. As long as you're embalming people in a way that doesn't cause problems, then there's, you know, particularly for humans, because you can't really cause problems for God, then there's nothing fundamentally wrong here. Does that help you out, Phil?
Hang on, Phil. Let me get you on the air. Does that help you?
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate the time you took to answer. Just one point of clarity, if you don't mind. Sorry.
Sure.
Just the environmental question was just about, not necessarily about the body decomposing, but just about the chemicals. But you kind of touched on that, I guess, suppose, with the formaldehyde piece as well. But just the chemicals in the ground was kind of that concern. But I appreciate all the clarity, and I just want to say I always love when you wear a superhero t-shirt. I'm a big DC Comics fan, so I've seen some Flash and Green Lantern t-shirts over the time.
Yep. I'm a DC Comics fan too. I've got a lot of DC Comics t-shirts. By the way, I would mention, regarding, like, after you put the formaldehyde in the body and you put the body in the ground, typically what people do is they put them in a coffin. And often these are metal coffins that will block water flow. They're sometimes put in cement with cement coverings as well. And so that formaldehyde in any normal time scale is not going to be leaking out into the ground anyway.
Phil, thank you very, very much. Jimmy, before I go to the break, it's conceivable then, unless I'm mistaken, that the body of Jacob and the body of Joseph could be found.
Oh, I mean, sure. Well, hypothetically, they could still exist. We have, in fact, mummified remains of pharaohs that lived long before Jacob and Joseph. But when the Israelites left Egypt at the Exodus, they took those bodies with them and they put them in a cave, the cave at Machpelah, Abraham's family's ancestral burying ground in Egypt. And if they were still there, we'd probably know about them.
Oh, yeah. We would probably know about them already. Yeah. All right. We'll take a break. Phil, thanks again for the call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now, our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Human beings are God's greatest masterpiece. Every person is made in the image and likeness of God. But every saint, that is, every person who accepts God's invitation, his upward call to make them holy. And so every story presents us with a unique masterpiece that God is writing.
The Journey Home, Monday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and television.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It is open forum, and the lines have just stayed full today, as they often do when Jimmy is here. But you're welcome to call. As lines open up, we'll get you on 888-318-7884. Next, we're going to Louisiana. Mark's in Louisiana. Mark, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Mark? Oh, I think Mark might be on what's that thing? Mute. I'm going to come back to you, Mark. Right now, I'll go to Matt in Michigan watching on YouTube. Mark, don't go anywhere, though. I'm going to come back and try you again. Matt in Michigan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Cy. Hey, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. I am a lifelong Protestant who's now making my way into the church. And
oh, great.
I have some questions. Obviously, mm-hmm. Mary is a big issue for people like me. Mm-hmm. And I have been listening to a lot of your content and Trent Horn and others. But I am wondering how we read Revelation in its tense, and mm-hmm. how do we pick out what is present, future, past, and especially focusing in on the Revelation chapter 12 about the woman and giving mm-hmm. birth. The second part of my question would be, why does it describe her as giving, having labor pains, if we also can say Mary did not have labor pains as a result of the curse because she's sinless?
Okay. So in regard to both of these questions, the church does not have a teaching. The church does not have any teaching about how to interpret, you know, which parts of Revelation pertain to the past or the present or the future. And similarly, the church doesn't have a teaching regarding Mary and labor pains. So all we can do here is use informed biblical interpretation and speculation on these issues. So what I can do with regard to the first question is tell you how I read the book of Revelation. And I've done an extensive study of this. Now, pretty much everybody agrees that the early chapters of Revelation, at least through chapter 3, pertain to the first century, to the beginning of Christian history. And pretty much everybody agrees that the final chapters of Revelation, like from the end of chapter 20 forward, pertain to the end of Christian history. The question is about that chunk in the middle, from the beginning of chapter 4 to the end, to the kind of the middle of chapter 20. Where does that apply to? And there are different theories. One theory is that most of that material, or all of that material, is bunched up towards the beginning of Christian history. Another says that it's spread out through Christian history so that you have, you know, maybe chapter 4 applies to the 2nd century and chapter 5 applies to the 3rd century, and you have kind of a roadmap of Christian history. There's also another view that says this material applies to the bulk of Christian history, but not in a kind of roadmap or timeline way. Instead, it reflects material that's going to come up periodically throughout church history. And then you have the futurist position that says the bulk of this material applies to events that are still in our future, towards the end of Christian history. So those are sort of the four basic positions. And by the way, Cy Kellett, I've got a book like 20 Answers Revelation.
Okay.
I want to make sure that we send Matt a copy of it.
All right.
Now, I think that the evidence best supports the view that most of this material applies to the beginning of Christian history. That's not to say it also doesn't contain themes that recur in Christian history, and it's not to say that there won't in the future be a recapitulation of some of these same themes. But if you look at the book of Revelation itself in its literal sense, meaning what was the author trying to communicate to his audience? What would the original audience have understood him to mean? I think it's clear he's talking about stuff that's going to happen towards the beginning of Christian history, because he says this is going to happen soon. And he says that at the beginning of the book, that this vision reveals what's going to happen soon. And he says it at the end of the book, that this vision reveals what's going to happen soon. And although soon can be taken in counterintuitive senses, the natural sense is soon from John's perspective. And so that gives us a significant piece of evidence that would suggest that this material is going to be happening towards the beginning of Christian history. There are other pieces of evidence within the book that also suggests that. A careful study, for example, of the beast with seven heads suggests that the seven heads represent the line of Roman emperors in the first century. And so that would be more evidence that the book, that the center part of the book where the beast is featured, that that also applies to the beginning of Christian history. There's also a challenge that needs to be met. If you want to say that most of the book primarily applies to the future, then you got a problem, because you need to find a place in the book that represents a long period of time. Because you've got, if most of the book applies to the future, then there needs to be something in the book that conveys the idea of a long period of time passing where we can fit in. If most of it's in our future, well, we need to be somewhere in this book. So where are we? Well, if you read through the book looking for a long period of time, there is one. It's at the beginning of chapter 20, where we have this millennium, or period of a figurative 1,000 years. That's a number that just means a lot, and so here we have this long period of time. But notice it's at the end. It's in chapter 20, right before the material everybody agrees is in our future. And what that suggests is the material that precedes Revelation 20 is in our past, and we're living in that millennium right now. It's a period where the devil is bound in such a way that he can't stop the proclamation of the gospel, and thus can't deceive the nations, because the gospel is going forward. So I think that's the most natural relation of the book of Revelation to history. And you can read more about that in my book, 20 Answers Revelation. When it comes to the second part of your question, Matt, about the woman in Revelation 12, the first thing I would say is that this woman, although she does represent Mary because she's depicted as giving birth to Jesus, so of course she's his mom, duh, she's not limited to the Virgin Mary. She also represents the nation, the people of Israel. And we see that because she's got she's clothed in the sun, she's got the moon at her feet, and she's got a crown of 12 stars. That imagery is drawn from Joseph's dream in the book of Genesis, where it represents the family of Israel. And so just like the Virgin Mary is the individual woman that gives birth to the Messiah, the nation of Israel is the nation that gives birth to the Messiah. And you can also look at her as representing, in some sense, the church, the spiritual Israel. And you could even propose that she's, in some sense, she's being represented as the new Eve, because notice we have a conflict here between the woman, her seed, and the ancient serpent. Just like in Genesis 3:15, John is using the image of the dragon, which he tells us is the ancient serpent or the devil. And we've got a conflict with the woman, the woman's seed, Jesus, and the serpent. So we also have here a recapitulation of Genesis 3:15. So what does that mean in terms of the birth pangs that she experiences? Well, okay, first thing is, since she represents more than one thing, it would be possible for the birth pains to apply, say, to the nation of Israel, but not literally to the Virgin Mary herself. So one possibility would be to understand the birth pains as applying, you know, to something other than the individual Mary. They may be representing a more collective experience of Israel went through a lot of convulsions when the Messiah was brought forth into the world, and that was certainly true. On the other hand, it never actually says, if you read Genesis, God doesn't say, I'm going to create birth pains that you otherwise would never experience. What God says to Eve is, because you've eaten this fruit, I'm going to multiply your birth pains. And so that would suggest that Mary, that Eve and women in general would have had birth pains even in an unfallen state. They just wouldn't have been as bad as they are now. And so it's not actually teaching, church teaching, that Mary didn't have birth pains. She might have had birth pains and they were just less severe than those that a fallen woman would have had. So that's another possible explanation along those lines. There's more that I could say, but we're getting close to the end of the hour, so I hope that's sufficient, Matt.
And Matt, hang on. We'll send you a copy of Jimmy's book, 20 Answers Revelation. If you just give us an address, we'll get it off to you. Let's try Mark in Louisiana again. Mark, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. How are y'all?
Doing okay. What can I do for you? We're getting close to the end of the hour.
Okay. I hope I don't complicate it by asking it the wrong way, but I want to pose a situation where people spontaneously start to pray for someone.
Okay.
But you may not agree theologically with them because you're of different faith. And so to what degree should I accept a prayer for someone? Just suppose someone who's satanic and they want to start praying for you. And then there's the other extreme where it's John Paul II who wants to pray for you. So you're getting the crux of my question. Where is it? Where is it?
Okay, so if you have someone who's praying to the creator of the universe, even if they're not a Christian, if they're praying to the creator of the universe, then the creator of the universe, God, knows that they're talking to him. And so if someone wants to pray to the creator of the universe for me, I'm fine with that, even if they don't understand the creator of the universe fully properly. On the other hand, they could be praying to someone else. Like, let's suppose it's Zeus. Okay, Zeus was a deity in the Greek pantheon. He was not the creator of the universe, but he was a spiritual being. And I'd say, well, I don't really think there is a Zeus. Thank you for the prayer, but you know, I'm not spiritually opening myself to help from Zeus. So you know, if someone's specifically praying to a non-Christian deity for me, I'm gonna kind of close myself to that. You know, if there's someone out there impersonating Zeus, it's probably a demon. I don't want to really be helped by that person. On the other hand, if someone is openly praying to a demon on my behalf, it's like, whoa, thank you, but no, I would like Saint Michael to protect me and keep any demonic activity far away from me. So I would definitely be closed to someone openly praying to the forces of darkness for me. That's a separate question than would I tell them shut up, you know, there could be different circumstances on that. They got a knife at my throat. I might not tell them to shut up right now. I might just ask St. Michael for his protection.
Mark, thank you very much for the question. I'm glad we got to talk with you. Lots more folks on the line. Should be two lines open during the break if you'd like to call. We'd like to get you in the line, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. He'll be back for another hour. It's open forum. You're welcome to ask whatever you like. You don't have to be Catholic to call. 888-318-7884.